Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First this morning, the entire country was of course shocked and outraged 10 days ago at the horrific attack on Kevin Lunny, the Quinn Industrial Holdings executive. Well, this morning's papers and the Irish Times are all carrying the story of a parish priest in Ballyconnell in County Cavan, Father Oliver O'Reilly, who's delivering a devastatingly powerful and damning homily this morning at Mass on the attack. And I'm now joined by Father O'Reilly, who's kind enough to take the time out to talk to us this morning, just before he goes into Mass to deliver his sermon. Thanks so much for joining us, Father O'Reilly. And I know you just told me everyone calls you Father Ollie, so I'm going to call you Father Ollie. First of all, why, Father, did you decide to write and deliver this homily?
I suppose the main reason I spoke out was my fear of loss of life and livelihood in this region, which has a history of emigration over many generations. The so-called Celtic Tiger did bring a degree of prosperity and optimism to this region. And I have ministered here for 16 years in three different parishes. And I think I have some sort of affinity and understanding of the ordinary people living in this area. And I also know the directors of Quinn Industrial Holdings, Darrell Riley, Liam McCaffrey, John McCartan, and the Lunny brothers, Kevin and Tony. And they're the most decent men you could meet in the world, and they're people of great integrity. So they have natural leadership, which has been honed with years of experience. And they have lived under a cloud of constant harassment and intimidation for the last 5 years. And I really fear for their lives. I guarantee you that if they step aside, no one else will fill their shoes. And that will mean the loss of 830 jobs to the local economy, and not to talk about the social impact this will create. Now, I know people, some people, small minority of people, think I'm talking nonsense. But I don't think I do. I believe I'm talking straight talk. And I suppose what I done was, I tried to speak about the elephant in the room, at least to broach this topic. And I suppose that's why people are interested in what I am saying or what I have said.
It's very powerful reading the newspapers this morning, on all the covers of the newspapers and the Irish Times yesterday. I mean, you're really talking about the savage thugs who did this. You describe it as barbaric, Father Ollie. Yes. You almost say you wished you'd spoken out before, but that you feel a Rubicon has now been crossed.
That's correct. And I believe that. Like, the savagery of this incident was unbelievable. I never thought I would witness it in this area. Look, I have been for years here. I know all the actors are on the stage in this whole carry-on. And I am, look, I admire the courage of the people that are carrying on their lives as best they can. And I am disgusted with those that threaten others. You know, I tried to be a Christian leader in this region with others. But this is utterly abhorrent to all the basic things, even the people who subscribe to even the basic tenets of Christianity.
And also in your homily, Father Ollie, you denounced the paymasters.
Yes, this is the elephant in the room. And I think, like, I'm aware, Miriam, that everyone knows about this elephant in the room. Even Charlie Flanagan, the Minister for Justice, knows about it. The Gardaí, the PSNI. And I would ask that the same state resources that have been poured into Limerick, Dublin and Drogheda in recent times, because of the whole drug scourge, which has given positive results. We don't have that same. We have a small amount of drug problems in the area, but nothing of any significance, and this has nothing to do with drugs. So I would ask that some of the resources please be given to this region so that this scourge can be removed from our midst. I refer to it as a cancerous evil, and I believe it is, that we have to exercise before it destroys everything that is good in this region.
And Father Ollie, I think you also talk about how maybe many people in your region need to examine their consciences themselves about public meetings they've attended, or how you've all, in a sense, approached this in the past.
Of course. And I didn't attend any of the meetings. I don't agree with those meetings. But I would have heard everything that went on from every single one of those meetings, reports on them. And people got up, people that I was surprised about, and gave angry rants, as I mentioned. And really, those angry rants are intimidatory and indirectly lead to violence. And that's what hurts me, so to speak, in the sense that good, ordinary people can be so misled in these situations.
And the reason, Father Ollie, you're speaking out this morning in this homily, why do you feel it's important to do this now?
I think unless we face the elephant in the room, I think this will continue. And I am fearful that next time round, people will be killed or people will be murdered. And I would feel so guilty if I hadn't at least gave this warning.
And finally, Father Ollie, because I know you need to go and to deliver this homily, were you nervous at all or anxious about deciding to speak out like this?
Utterly nervous and anxious. And as I speak to you, this is not... I have limelight. Putting myself in the limelight is just foreign to me, totally. I feel totally uncomfortable. But when I came by, I was away on holidays in Spain, and I called on Tony Lunny, brother of Kevin's, on Thursday night when I came back. And through a man was totally traumatised. He's a brother to Kevin, and he's also one of the directors. But what he said to me woke me up, so to speak. And I went back at maybe 10 or 11 o'clock, and I started writing. Because I said, look, this good man and his colleagues need support. And that was, I suppose, it was a call... It woke me up to what these people are going through.
Well, look, Father Ollie, thank you very much this morning for taking the time to speak to us, and I wish you the very, very best. I know you're off now to deliver that homily.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Miriam.
And thanks again, Father Ollie. And lovely and so kind of him to chat to us this morning, even though he was heading off to Mass to deliver that homily. I've now been joined in studio by Keela. Good morning, Brian Hogan, Ross O'Snodig and Colm O'Snodig. You're going to play live for us. What a treat. What are you going to do for us first?
Put the oar.
Intak. Off you go.
Tour Bosch, 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 T
what a treat live this morning. And I know the Tradition Now Festival you're part of is at the National Concert Hall from the 1st to the 6th of October. It's a great festival, obviously. Steve Cooney, Lisa O'Neill, Paddy Glacken, lots of people. All the details are on nch.ie. You're going to go off, have a coffee and come back and sing for me later on the show, and I'll promote more of your day. Former TD Kathleen Lynch has had a long and varied career in politics. She cut her teeth in local politics, representing her working class area of Spangle Hill on Cork's north side, and eventually rising to become a Minister of State at the Department of Health with special responsibility for primary care, social care, disabilities, older people and mental health. First elected to Cork Corporation as a member of the Workers' Party in 1985, she went on to join the Democratic Left and eventually entered the Dáil in 94. There were elections lost and won and lost again, but now she's just announced the end of her political road and she will not be contesting her seat. And she joins me now from Cork. Good morning, Kathleen Lynch.
Morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, was it difficult to make the decision not to go for another election?
Of course it was. And just listening to your introduction about elections lost and won, you know, I lost so many elections that it always came as a surprise when I did win. So, you know, it's that sort of dogged determination that makes you say that, no, I'll go again. But, you know, there comes a time when you have to make a decision. And I've been thinking about it for some time. And we got John Maher elected in the local elections with an incredible vote coming from nowhere, really. And I felt it was time to say that, you know, there is someone there that I feel can represent the sector of society that I've always represented. And I was absolutely thrilled to be able to say, John, do you want to do this? And he was, you know, he was delighted with the opportunity. So it was hard. It was very difficult. The only people I consulted were a very, very small group of people that I would absolutely trust. I didn't sort of go to the wider membership because I knew it would always be, I know, don't look, come on, we can do this. And, you know, there was a possibility that it could be done. But I think there is a time as well when you have to pass it on to a new generation, and that new generation I have every confidence in.
Now listen, growing up, I gather you're the youngest of 11. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about your background growing up, and you also suffered a really bad accident when you were 10, which changed your life in a way, didn't it, Kathleen?
Well, it did. I ran under a double-decker bus coming home from school when I was 10. And as my mother said, you know, would you not have waited for a car? But that was never my way. So I then spent 7 years in hospital, coming out at various intervals. But seven grueling years. Yes, they saved my leg. And yes, they were extremely good to me. But the Sisters of Mercy, who were running the hospital at the time, I always credit them with my political education because I could read anything I liked, provided it didn't have sex and romance. So Mills and Boons were out, but I could read the Connolly columns, and I could read anything by Lenin and Marx and all of those things. But anything that had any bit of romance in it was banned. So I credit the nuns for that. Yeah.
Why did you go into politics? Like, where did you get that idea?
Well, the sense of helplessness. I mean, those years in hospital when you weren't consulted, and you know, looking back on it, why would you be consulted? I was a child. Operations that you were simply told you'd be going up on Monday morning and off you went. And I always felt that sense of helplessness, that sense of not being heard, that sense of, and I'm not certain I would have made any different decisions from the people that were making them for me, but I did always feel that awful sense of helplessness, and that not being heard, that not being asked for your input, not being asked for your opinion, and that stayed with me. So, you know, I got involved in the local residents' association after I got married, and I became very active with them. And then the local elections hadn't been held for 7 years, I think, at the time. And I think it was that election actually determined that it was set in stone that it would be every 5 years after that, set in legislation that it would be 5 years after that. So the Workers' Party approached me. They asked me to stand. They guaranteed me I would not be elected. They guaranteed me. And that's what I'm saying about sort of, you know, it always came as both a shock and a surprise when I was elected. And I was elected and I couldn't believe it. And to such an extent that I phoned the town clerk's office on the Monday morning. The election, I was finally elected on the Saturday, even though the count had taken 2 days because I was 2 votes ahead of my nearest rival on the 15th count. And I reckon that, you know, two people in that ward went in, gave me number 14 and him number 15 on two separate occasions. Didn't think much of any of the two of us. But I got elected and I did phone the town clerk's office and say, you know, how do I give this back? And they laughed and said, it's not quite that simple. But in order to ensure that, you know, I was going to do the job properly, like everything I've ever taken on in life, I kind of went at it with gusto and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
And it's been such a long and varied career, Kathleen, highs and lows. And yes. It's hard to know what to ask you about. There's so much. But tell me about the budget a few years ago, I think, when you were home in Cork, expected to come to Dublin to vote for, but you were told there was no money for mental health.
Well, that was an every year event during the budget, but it never came to the point where I was actually phoned on the morning of the budget and said, well, you know, we're very sorry, but, you know, you're not getting any money this year. They didn't say we don't have any money. They said, you're not getting any money this year for mental health. Oh, I said, that's okay. So after about an hour, they phoned back and they said, where are you? I said, I'm in Cork. And they said, but where are you in Cork? Oh, I said, I'm lying on the bed. I said, it's a lovely day and, you know, I think I'll stay. And a sort of everything broke loose, panic. You know, what do you mean you're staying? You're not coming to Dublin. What about the vote? And I said, sure, what would I be voting for? You're not giving me anything. So what's the point? And I knew, you know, it wasn't, I'm saying it now in a flippant manner, but it wasn't that flippant. I knew exactly what I was doing. I knew that if I stayed there and I didn't vote for that budget, then at the end of the day, I was walking away from, you know, not so much my seat in the Dáil, but from government. And I felt there was so much that needed to be done. But I was prepared to do that because I think if you're not prepared to dig in your heels and fight for what you believe, then people won't take you seriously. They really won't take you seriously.
We hear all the time, Kathleen, about the importance of having women going into politics, getting more representation. Now, at the end of your political career, do you think it is tough for women in politics? Do you think it's tough for everyone in politics, but especially for female representatives?
I think it's tough for women that have responsibilities at home. I think it's very tough for them. I think it can be quite challenging and maybe even, you know, enjoyable for women at a certain age. But for that in-between piece, that piece where you have children that you're responsible for, even extended family members that you're responsible for, or feel you have a responsibility for, and I think most women feel that responsibility, I think it is tougher. It is definitely tougher. You know, there's the phone call, ma'am, I can't find, you know, my shirt, or, you know, I'm going to school in the morning and where's the book? And, you know, I had a bad day in school and the teacher was giving out, and you're not there. You're not there, and you know you're not there, and you feel absolutely that sort of responsibility, and yet you have a job to do as well, and that job is very important for them because you are their role model, and you must say that it can be done, even though I do not believe in the superwoman concept. I know, Miriam, it's often thrown at you, but
it doesn't exist.
A few years ago I was asked by someone that, well, you know, what do you think is the most essential thing for a politician? I said a wife. And no, I don't care whether that wife is male or female, but someone that looks after you, someone that, you know, makes sure that you're okay, you know, that you know, it's not just about the job, that it's about you as well. And I think that doesn't happen in politics. And I've seen an awful lot of good politicians, you know, both leave and been seriously damaged by their, I suppose, their inner core and their mental well-being not being catered for.
Finally, Catherine, when you now look ahead to the rest of your life, are you looking forward to doing something other than politics? Are you going to take a break, or what are you going to do?
Well, I've announced that I'm not going to be involved in standing for elections, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to be involved in politics. I mean, when I look back at the first campaign we were involved in, which was equality for social welfare for married women, you know, the biggest payment the state ever made at the time, the Magdalens, the mental health area, you know, the review of the Mental Health Act. When I look back on all of those things, I think there are things that now need to be challenged as well. I'm now convinced that class is as important as gender. And it's great. And I mean, I know a lot of the women that were appointed to the bench as judges. But, you know, I'm not certain that they're my peers. And I'm not certain that, you know, standing in front of women from a certain sector of society, you know, people where I come from, that it is fully equality. And I think that the equality issue now needs to be stepped up a pace. And, you know, I intend to be involved in shouting for those things, in shouting for people with disabilities, for people with mental health, that, you know, making sure that the whole community sector in relation to mental health, as opposed to the institutional sector, needs to be put in place.
Well, Kathleen Lynch, I'd say you've got a great future, have you? Lots of respect here on our machine from Twitter and email. It says, I'll give you just two of them. Miriam, tell Kathleen Lynch, best of luck in her retirement. She's going to be missed. She did a great job. That's from Deirdre. Another says, sorry to hear Kathleen's retiring from politics, but you're not, actually. Our efforts on behalf of mental health were excellent. Another says, sport for choice and reasons to admire Kathleen Lynch, but by top is as a founding member of a badass group of housewives, married women for equality, who forced an unwilling state to fully implement the EU directive on equality. Kathleen Lynch, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I wish you the very best of luck for the future.
Thank you, Miriam.
Take care. Well, most of us have heard of Bernadette, the young girl who was chosen to be visited by Our Lady in Lourdes in 1858. And once word spread, the town became one of the most important Catholic pilgrimage sites in the world. And Bernadette herself was canonised in 1933. Well, Bernadette's story and those who have visited the shrine and the stories of cures and miracles which occurred for those who bathed in the town's spring water have been told in a new book by Colm Keane and Una O'Hagan. And they join me now in studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for coming in. Look, the last time you were here with me, you were telling us the story of St. Thérèse of Lisieux. Today it's Bernadette. Tell me about her. What is it about her story that appealed to you both so much? Una.
Well, I think it dates back to 1973. I'm sure you're too young, Miriam, to remember
definitely.
That. But it was a Good Friday. And in those days, there was very little to do. I remember vividly sitting down to watch television and I saw the film The Song of Bernadette.
Yeah.
And it must be one of the most moving films that has ever been made. It was made in came out in 1944. And it told her Bernadette's story. I so empathised with her because I felt I was the same age. Her story was so dramatic and so tragic and epic. I think I went through about two boxes of tissues. It was just so sad. And she has always stuck with me. You couldn't make up a story like her. And what happened then in Lourdes and the millions of people who visit her, her shrine or the shrine to Our Lady, that kind of sums it up for me.
So did you always want to maybe do something about her, write a book or make a program?
I had always been aware of her, but last year, as you said, we were in with you when we were talking about Thérèse of Lisieux. And when we were researching that book, we just kept coming across, every time we looked up something about Thérèse, there would be something about Bernadette or about Lisieux, there'd be something about Lourdes. And it was almost like destiny, you know, that this was such a big story. And it was a story of the Irish and Lourdes that had never been told, and we maybe very immodestly decided we should tell it.
No, great idea. And of course, you're a married couple. Most people know that. And you did this together. So, and you're also a journalist. Colin, tell me about Bernadette's background. I think her and her family They were very poor, weren't they?
They were, yeah. Dirt poor, to use that phrase. They lived in Lourdes. Her father once had been a prosperous miller, and they had quite a lot of money and a very good life, but he fell on hard times. He actually became bankrupt. And in those days, hard times meant hard times. No social welfare, nothing like that. So they scraped a living. There was Bernadette, her sister, two brothers and the parents, and they were desperate for a place to live in, and they got this accommodation. It was an old prison cell called Le Cachot, which means the dungeon, and it was a one-roomed apartment, a basement apartment. I mean, it was a cesspit. We'd been there, and, you know, it smelled of manure, cracks on the wall, really atrocious conditions, and it was so sad. She had to go out when she was about 13 and forage for food and for firewood. I mean, the place was so cold in the winter time, roasting hot in the summertime. And when she was 13, they couldn't feed her, and she had to go off to a place nearby, a place called Bartres, where she became a shepherdess. And so sad. We went out there, we went into the same byre, the same barn, opening the same lock. There was nobody else there. There were stones she sat on, the field she was in with the sheep and with the lambs, and she loved the sheep and the lambs, and she remembered them for the rest of her life. But she got sick of it, not the sheep and the lambs, but the work. And she was only doing it for keep. And she came home in January 1858. She walked home alone, and 3 weeks later, the first vision.
Okay, Una, tell us about that. What happened apparently on the 11th of February 1858?
It was a bitterly cold morning, and Bernadette, her sister Toinette, and her sister's friend John Abadie, the three of them went out to forage for firewood. They couldn't afford to buy any. And they went to a place they'd never been to before called Massabielle, which is like a rocky outcrop. The two other girls went ahead of Bernadette. She lagged behind. She was trying to figure out how to get across a river. And she suddenly heard a rushing sound, like wind, she called it. And she looked towards the trees that were nearby, but she couldn't see the leaves moving. So she couldn't understand what was happening. She then looked back at the rock and noticed that there was a little rose bush that seemed to be moving as well. And behind the rose bush, in what appeared to be a niche, there was a light. And she later described this as she saw a figure in the light, and that it was the figure of what she called a beautiful lady, dressed in white, with a blue sash around her waist, and rosary beads on her right hand arm hanging down, and a gold or yellow rose on each of her feet. She was terrified, naturally, and she said she tried to say the rosary a number of times, then eventually managed to, and the lady said the rosary with her, and then the apparition finished. That was the first of 18 visions and the beginning of the story of the phenomenon that's Lourdes.
And what about, Colin, for people listening this morning, as maybe they're having their breakfast and they go, that's a beautiful story, but I don't believe a word of it.
It's a very legitimate question. The important thing about Bernadette is that she was investigated like nobody else in history. I really mean that. There was an imperial prosecutor who interrogated her, ecclesiastical court of inquiry, lawyers, doctors, journalists, authors, bishops, archbishops, the inspector of police gave her a very tough time. Now, these were learned, aged men, you know, and they were men, by the way, and she was 14. And even the people, if you take Inspector Jacquemet, just for example, even him, he was setting out, he was told, break her, you know, stop this stuff happening. We don't want it going on anymore. What was taking place at the grotto, too many people turning up and all that. Very interesting. He used every trick in the book. and he wrote copious notes about it. But afterwards, at the end of it, when he was summing up, he admitted, he said, do you know what? She never changes her story and she's highly credible. And everybody who met her ended up concluding that about her. So I never met her. I know of other people who did, in the sense they've written a lot about her. But I trust their judgment. They were esteemed individual and they meant what they said.
After she saw that first apparition, like she was only 13, was she, Una?
Just 14.
Yeah. What did she do? Do we know? Did she go back? Did she tell? Who did she tell?
Well,
did they believe her?
This is the thing. She told the two friends. They could see that something traumatic had happened. She was as white as a sheet. She told them what had happened, swore them to secrecy. And of course, as soon as they got home, Bernadette's sister told their mother. The other girl, Jean, told her mother. With a small town, you know, any small town in Ireland, sure, once there's a secret, everybody knows it. That's how it got out. And then it went to the parish priest, found out about it. This was just the beginning of the apparitions, don't forget. And when people heard about it, they went to try and find out what was happening. There's a famous story of, there's one very good eyewitness of the seventh apparition who talks about how Bernadette was transfixed, that he could see that there was obviously a conversation going on. He spoke about how she blessed herself and bowed. But the crowds began to gather more and more and more, and then the news got out, filtered out even further. And within 3 or 4 weeks, the news hit Dublin, came through on the electric telegraph to the offices of the Dublin Evening Mail in Parliament Street. And from then on, Ireland just took Bernadette and Lourdes to their heart.
And before we go to that Irish connection, you said obviously there wasn't just one apparition. So for people listening who don't know the Bernadette story, tell us about the subsequent apparitions.
Yeah, there were 18 in all. They went on from February until July. Now, there were a few key ones. Some of them were mundane. I hate to use that word, but they were. But one of the most important...
All to Bernadette.
Yeah. She was the only person there. And by the way, the other people there couldn't see them either. You know, they were witnessing her, witnessing Our Lady, but they couldn't see anything. But the most important, I think, is the ninth apparition. That was the 25th of February, 1858. There was a huge crowd of people. People were turning up in huge numbers and they expected something really edifying from Bernadette on that day, something very sacred and religious. It turned out to be the opposite. Bernadette, they were watching her and she started crawling along the ground. She looked demented, is what people said. She took earth up. She looked like she was smearing it on her face. It looked like she was eating the earth. Quite a lot of people on that day said, we're out of here, we're gone, and they left.
In other words, there's something wrong with her.
There's something really wrong with her. It's really strange territory. Yeah. But later on, at the end of it, Bernadette just walked away as if nothing had happened. And later, somebody spoke to her and said, what was that about? And she said, the lady said, go drink from the water and wash in it. And she thought to herself, what water? There was a river behind her, the River Gave, which is still there. And she turned to go towards it. And she said, no, the lady said, pointing at a spot, go there. And when she looked at this spot, there was a little bit of kind of mud, wet mud. And she went down and she said, I was trying to drink it, but I couldn't because it was mud. And she said she got sick 3 times. And then she looked like she was putting it on her face because she was bringing it up to her mouth. And that was it. And then she left. And there were a few women who heard this story afterwards and they said, wonder what that spot was. And they went over to it and they started clawing at it and a little rivulet of water started flowing. And then a few men came over and they had shovels and then the rivulet became a little spring. And the more they dug, the stronger it flowed. And that was the beginning, I think, of Lourdes. That was Lourdes water. We've had it in our houses, the little bottle, everybody. And that's the beginning of it. That day, 25th of February, 1858.
But why would Our Lady have chosen Bernadette of all the young women on the planet?
Yeah, I think she was picked because she was so ordinary in one way. She was just an ordinary girl, came from a poor family, and there are echoes of another, you know, poor family pretty much 2,000 years earlier. But I think Our Lady picked a very good person. She was tough. She was a Pyrenean extraction, and they have a reputation as of being independent-minded. And I think because Bernadette came under such ferocious attack by the church itself and other people, she had to be very special to be able to withstand that. I don't know if there's a definitive answer, but she was the right person to take on the challenge.
So let's talk about the miracles, which many people believe happened. Obviously, others won't believe them. But what was the first miracle? I think, was it a young boy called Justin? What happened
to
him?
Yeah, there was a woman just before him, Catherine Latapy. I talked a moment ago about the water. And she came over to it. She had actually fallen off a tree. And she was from Lourdes. And she had damaged her right arm. She couldn't move her hand. It was immobilized completely. And she went over and put her hand into the water. And afterwards, and again it was witnessed, she could move her hand. And everybody, and that is, by the way, the very first miracle. A young boy, Justin Buhart, an amazing story. And I'll tell you why it's amazing in a minute. He was dying from consumption. He was aged just two. And the neighbours had built a little coffin for him. And the father had given him up for dead. And the mother, whose name was Quazine, she said one night, desperation, and again it's well documented, she said, I'm not letting him die, I'm taking him over to the water. And Bernadette was there at the time, and she ran, evening time by the way, just getting dark, ran with this little baby, he had no clothes on, and he was comatose, and she went over to the water and she put him in the water and kept him there for 15 minutes, and people were screaming, you're killing him, you're killing him, he's going to die. She was pushing them away, and she said later she noticed a little revival in him in that period. She brought him home, and I'm cutting a long story short here, but within 2 days, he was not only back to life, but he was walking, and he had never walked before. Now, the bottom line of it, by the way, two of them, Justin Buhart, 75 years later, in 1933, you mentioned it in the introduction, canonization. He turned up at the canonization in Rome. He lived until the age of 79. It was extraordinary. But the biggest thing for anybody who says, you know, miracles happen because it's mind over matter. You know, you think yourself better from your lame leg. A two-year-old can't do that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great imponderables about the area of miracles when you think of that story.
And there's still obviously so many Irish people, you know, who travel to Lourdes, and some people do go hoping for cures. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is cured. Miracles don't happen. So why is it selective? Do you ever wonder that? Like, if Our Lady is all good, why are only some people selected to be cured?
I think it might depend on your definition of a miracle. I mean, you could go with a broken leg and say, you know, Our Lady, please, I'd like this leg to be cured. And, you know, it just doesn't happen like that. I mean, we lost our son, Sean, when he was 20. And you could say we had a miraculous time with him. You know, he was wonderful, great kid, really talented, you know, top of the class in school, had great friends, loved sport. But you could define that as a miracle. But yeah, there is a question of, you know, who gets a miracle and who doesn't. There's a story we came across written by a guy called John Gibbons. This was in the 1920s. And he was going to Lourdes and he spotted a young couple who were obviously very poor. And the young woman, she was a typist. The young man was a clerk. They had scraped together money for their wedding, but then realised that she was very, very ill. They spent that money on medical consultations, and they told her that there was no hope. And what the last money they had, they went to Lourdes. And I always get sad about this story, but you take it up.
But they went off to Lourdes and he lost sight of them. And then on the way back, he noticed them getting back on board the train, and he saw the young woman. He noticed she had a problem getting back onto the train, and he stood there and he said, "There's been no miracle." And he knew she had only a short time to live. And he said to himself, couldn't Our Lady, exactly your question, couldn't Our Lady have spared a little miracle for them? And when he got on board the train, he walked down to their carriage. He thought he'd go visit. And when he went in, he said they were sitting there and he was holding her hand. She had a shabby little glove on, he said, because they had no money. And he said he thought they'd be so depressed, but they were beaming with joy. And he thought, and the phrase he used, he said, it was like as if they were at the pictures on a Saturday afternoon. And he thought to himself, how could this be so? And then he went away, thought about it. Very bright man, John Gibbons. And he said, but most people on the train, they have no miracles and they're all terribly happy. Everybody is joyous and they're going home with nothing. And then it hit him. And he said, the reason is because they know that there is something more important. They're going to be together for eternity. And they're going to have a life together after she passes away. And he said, that's the miracle. That's the miracle they got from their visit. So Una is right. You know, the miracle isn't all about the bone healing. It can be something more than that. And you actually get that in Lourdes.
So do you mean the miracle almost is for people who believe in the afterlife that you end up together? Is that
maybe the miracle? Simple? Maybe the miracle is not avoiding death, put it that way, or not avoiding great illness. Sometimes a bigger miracle can be coping with it, getting a sense of serenity, which you can get in Lourdes. A miracle automatically in a lot of people's minds is, I was ill, now I'm fine. I think you need a bigger definition of what a miracle can be.
Is it also because you both lost your beautiful son, Sean, I'm thinking, to cancer? Is that why you both believe this even more? Because you almost have to believe it?
No.
Okay.
No. Because I wouldn't want to believe in a falsehood. You know, what's the point of doing that? I mean, we've been through a traumatic time and yet we still believe because... I'm trying to explain it. We saw what Sean went through. And after Sean died, there was an enormous sense of peace and calm and a sense that he had travelled on to somewhere else.
Mm.
And I think all the sceptics in the world cannot say, and sceptics are wonderful people because they know everything. They have the answer to everything, which is, no, it's not true. No, it doesn't happen. There's no explanation. Therefore, they are right. But they weren't in the room with us. And they didn't feel that. And nobody can contradict me on that.
Do you know, you step off the plane in Lourdes the first time that we got there. You walk down from the plane, foothills of the Pyrenees. There's a calmness. Una said it, tranquility and a peace about the place. Whenever you go around there, I mean, people talk about sitting and looking at the grotto where this, I mean, everybody, you're watching the faces and they're all looking and thinking, gosh, is that where there is a happiness there that I honestly have never encountered anywhere else. And we have done all the study, read all the books. I'm talking about hundreds.
Yeah.
And everybody who's written about it says the same thing. They don't really, even though they do talk about the miracles, they talk about a different thing.
Well, we talked about some of the other miracles. What about, there was one in 1870, a Kerry woman called Agnes?
Yeah, Sister Arsenius, Agnes Morrow Bernard, a Kerry woman. She was in Dublin. She was age 28. She suffered from chronic eczema and she had these open sores on her face and they became infected with streptococcal bacteria, which was very serious given there were no antibiotics. And she developed an illness called erysipelas. Or something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, sounds good.
It was very serious. And
you're right.
Thank you. Say it with confidence. But it was life-threatening. The biggest symptom of it that she was dealing with was excruciating pain in her head. She was in hospital in St. Vincent's. It was around then, believe it or not. She was a nun in the Sister of Charity order. There was an operation was scheduled to take place. It was an absolutely gruesome thing they were planning to do to her, which was to drill a hole in her skull to relieve pressure. Now, how this was going to deal with the actual infection, I don't know, but that was all they could do. Agnes's mother had heard about Lourdes, sent out the word, get my daughter Lourdes water, it's going to cure her. And it so happened that Agnes's nurse, a friend of hers, called the night before to the hospital the night before the operation. And the friend said to Agnes's nurse, who had a problem with her eyesight, here's a bit of Lourdes water, it might help your eyesight. Not a bit of it for the sister. Otter and Kerr was her name. She ran into Agnes's bedside. I said, I've got it, and put drops of Lourdes water on her head. The following day, Dr. O'Leary came in. This is all documented. Dr. O'Leary came in, touched her head, and normally she would be in excruciating agony, would scream with pain. It was fine, did it again. She was recovered. And he said, cancel the operation. This is beyond medical science. And that's the first recorded miracle associated with Lourdes and Lourdes water that we could come across.
And actually, that's just one of the many brilliant stories in this book, Una and Colm. It's called The Village of Bernadette by Colm Keane and Una O'Hagan. It's published by Capel Island Press and it's in all good bookshops now. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in this morning. We've also been joined in studio back by Keila, Brian Hogan, Rosso, Snoddy, Colm Snoddy. One of you was just telling me your grandfather was cured at Lourdes. Lots of people are listening going, they don't believe a word of this.
But the family story.
Go on.
Mihalo Snuddy from Carlo had TB and he had a piece of his shin put into his lower back and he couldn't walk and he was told he'd never walk again. He went to Lourdes and threw in his walking sticks and says, you can take them back, ma'am. And he was walking after that. So this is a story my dad told us. He witnessed it. He never wanted to. People came looking for information off him and he wouldn't said, that's my private business. So obviously not private anymore, but anyway.
No, it's just so interesting. But look, you're going to be appearing as part of the tradition now at the National Concert Hall. It's on from the 1st to the 6th of October. All the details for that are on nch.ie. Tell me a bit about it, the tradition now.
The tradition now, yeah. It's a five-piece gig and it's basically showing kids, I suppose, entertaining kids, introducing them to the tradition, introducing them to different instruments, to tunes, different rhythms, that kind of thing.
And you're also, I know, you're going to be playing Kilkenny on October the 5th, isn't that right? And then Féile Cíl in the National Stadium on December the 21st.
Féile Cíl is our big Christmas show. We've been doing it for 20 years and last year we moved it to the National Stadium. A big step up and we had Imelda May playing, we had Michael D. Higgins coming along, we had all kinds of surprises and it's going to be the same again. And kneecap as well, yeah. So we're doing it again on the 21st of December in the stadium.
Now, what are you going to play us out on today?
We're going to play Cardinal Knowledge, and this goes out for Gavin Ralston, who passed away during the week. So, up, Cav.
Off you go, Keila, and thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Ian Zuckerfall, it's just a joy to watch the three of you, though, because you love playing together, don't you?
Sometimes.
How long have you been playing together, actually?
32 years.
30.
I'm only 23. I'm new.
And you enjoy it just as much. Well, lots of lovely reactions saying, oh, good morning. Please say hi to Keila, Miriam. I love them. Going to definitely go along to that tradition now. And then just before we go, I want to read out, we had lots of texts about Father Oliver O'Reilly. He was our first guest this morning. I bring you to, one of our listeners says, Father Oliver O'Reilly showing great courage in speaking out on the torture Kevin Lonnie received and condemning this vile attack. And one other listener says, such strong words from your guest, Father Ollie. I hope the powers of be listening to him and will use his wise advice to solve the awfulness of such a sad attack. Lots of reaction to Una and Colm as well as to yourselves. People saying they went to Lourdes. I'll give you one. I love everything Una and Colm are saying. I get it. I've been there. I've seen how people will find themselves and their happiness in just being themselves. Everybody experiences a little miracle in themselves. Well, my thanks today to our BCO was Denise Davies. Mark McGraw was on sound. Sean O'Gorman produced. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, thanks so much for listening and have a good day.